It's poverty.
It's crime.
Unemployment.
Corruption.
Accountability.
The energy crisis.
Inflation.
We are worried.
That South Africa has myriad problems on all fronts is a given. But the time has come for us to look for real solutions. I'm Jeremy Maggs, and this MoneyWeb podcast will discuss those solutions on how South Africans can solve problems by having tough conversations and drawing on the insights of South Africa's top business leaders. Welcome to Fix SA. Welcome to another episode of Fix SA here on MoneyWeb. Conversations committed to finding solutions and viable approaches to the complex and multifaceted issues and problems facing South Africa. My name is Jeremy Maggs. Now, the head of the Special Investigating Unit is Advocate Andy Motibe, and he is tasked with leading the SIU to, and I quote, execute its mandate to investigate maladministration, malpractice and corruption within state institutions and the private sector. And my thinking here, and the reason why we've asked him to join us today, is that if we get that side of the equation right, we can go a long way to fixing the country. Advocate Motibe says he strives for a corruption-free South Africa, making a meaningful impact in the public sector, the private sector, and society generally by ensuring accountability and this thing called consequence management for wrongdoers in all tiers of government, inclusive of those private sector parties involved in the wrongdoing itself. Andy Motibe, a very warm welcome to you, and thank you so much for joining us. I wonder if I can just steal 10 seconds of your time and give you two quotes. The first is from Delia Ferreira, who is chair of Transparency International, and she says, people's indifference is the best breeding ground for corruption to grow. And a shorter quote from Pope Francis, who says, corruption is paid for by the poor. I'm wondering how those two quotes resonate with you in the South African context.
Jeremy, it does resonate. You remind me of another saying that says, corruption thrives when good men and women sit and not take action, so to speak. So really, the indifference that people show to the wrongdoing and to the corruption ultimately makes the poor to pay. And we have seen a clear demonstration of that by the results that corruption has caused to the poor, and of course to the South African public in general, in various of the living aspects. We have seen it in some of the investigations that we do in the education space, where monies that were meant for the poor students who would have used the money to study, better their lives, so that they can compete in the job market. That money has been used for personal ends by the corrupt officials. And of course, there is a collusion here. There's always that private sector aspect where companies also are involved. So that's in the education space. In the, I would say, electricity space that everyone can relate to. We have been investigating at Eskom for a long while, and we have come up with a whole number of findings and observations. Just the typical example when we investigated in the coal delivery space. Jeremy, we have found that there is collusion between the suppliers and the Eskom employees to the extent that a truck full of coal would really just make a turn at the Eskom plant and go back with the coal. In other instances, a truck has got no coal, it comes, it's recorded, and it goes back. But at the end of the day, all of those are recorded as deliveries to Eskom, and monies get paid, and the officials benefit, of course. And who suffers? The South African public suffers. But we have gone a long way. We have gone a long way in all of these aspects where we have made the findings, and those officials and companies who are involved have seen consequences being meted out to them, in the sense that we have, from our side, even went further and recovered all the monies and the assets that those corrupt people amassed corruptly. Those assets have been recovered and forfeited to the state. The officials have faced disciplinary process in Eskom itself, and they have been terminated. Their employment has been terminated. I had a chat just last week with the new Eskom CEO, Mr. Dan Maropane, just shared with him our investigations to date. I can tell you he has really assured us that we can be assured that he's going to take consequence management against all of those involved. He was at the time, you know, visiting various power stations, and he's aware of the matters. So I'm really citing these examples. There's other examples we can make. In the lottery investigations, Jeremy, this is now with a point of view of really demonstrating, you know, the impact of all this corruption onto the poor, right? In the lottery space, I mean, the lottery, as you would know, some of the proceeds there have to be used for benefit of the poor. And of course, people go there and apply using non-governmental organizations, non-profit organizations. But what we have seen the abuse of these NPOs and NGOs with the collusion of the lottery officials, where there's a business process there. They call it grant system. In fact, they even add the word proactive grant system, where the officials of lottery would go out, you know, and go and look for people with NPOs and then collude with them. They say, make an application for this amount. It's paid out, and the officials of lottery get the money, and the money ends up not being useful. It could have been, say, applied under the guise that it's going to do a shelter for the poor or for the disabled, old age home, and so on. But none of those gets done.
I have to say, Andy, that's the first time I've ever heard that phrase used before. I want to ask you this question, though. Do you feel sometimes that you are a little overwhelmed, that there are small wins that you've pointed out, whether it be in the lottery space, the Eskom space, or the education space, small wins, but do you really believe that as we try to fix South Africa, we are winning this big corruption battle?
Thank you for that question, Jeremy. You know, we've often been asked, you know, whether are we winning as a country? Are we of the view as SAU whether we're winning, you know, the war against corruption? And the question goes further, what's our view on the extent of corruption? And I have often responded and said, there is no doubt that, you know, corruption is endemic, you know, in state institutions, not forgetting private institutions who play a role as well. And we've seen the magnitude. I mean, just in the last financial year, we received about 1,700 reports of corruption allegations, which, of course, we have processed and are busy getting proclamations, because we can only investigate after proclamation is signed by the president. So the magnitude of those reports and what we are finding as investigators, Jeremy, we are extremely, extremely overwhelmed. But of course, we take into account that we need to resource ourselves appropriately, including the expertise that we need, so that we can deal with these investigations appropriately. And we have seen the results. So to a large extent, and again, I need to also indicate that you know, we are collaborating with other state agents like the Hawks, like the Investigative Directorate, and of course within the state itself, we've got the Public Service Commission. In the police, we've got the IPIT, you know, Independent Directorate, again to investigate the police. We work closely. So the question whether we are really winning the battle or the war, and I can hear, you know, say, representing my colleagues, that, you know, it's a collective yes. We think we're really turning the corner in the battle against corruption. And why am I saying so? It's because, you know, if you look previously, and again, the years that are covered by some of our investigations and the years covered by the Zondo Commission report, those previous years, you can see that, you know, there has been quite a displeasing inaction on the part of state institutions. Some of them, of course, are said to have been hollowed out, such as NPA, the South African Revenue Service, we as SIU, if I were to say so myself. And of course, there has been other, you know, scholars who wrote about the work of the SIU before my time and now through my time. There is no indication that SIU was, to use the phrase, captured, you know. So as a result, over the years, I mean, 2 years back, we celebrated our 25 years. And we showed the work that SIU has been doing for the past 25 years, significant results reached. But of course, Jeremy, we require a collective action so that, you know, when we recover the assets and make sure that the monies are recovered, we need action to be taken against those officials who are involved and the private sector companies that are involved. We also need to see prosecution following against those. And this, Jeremy, will really create that view by the public. And again, the issue of public trust is important here. And the public, including our rural public, where, you know, poverty is palpable there. You know, our rural public and everyone in the public should see that government is really serious about the fight against corruption.
Advocate Motibi, let me ask you this question. You talk about action being taken, but you must be disappointed, surely, that there has not been more prosecution, that there's not been more consequence as a result of the findings of the Zondo Commission, which laid bare 10 wasted years in South Africa.
Yeah. Jeremy, of course, it's really, really concerning that there hasn't been prosecutions as yet. And I mean, we've had, I often say to my colleagues that, you know, the public expectation is so high that we need to action, you know, whatever we need to action and as quickly as is possible. The Zondo Commission made, shall I say, investigations and came up with evidence. From our side, we are actioning quite a number of those in Transnet. We have taken the contract of the locomotives that were procured as a result of the involvement of one of the Gupta companies. We have taken that to court for all those locomotives contracts to be cancelled so that we can recover. We are also actioning some of the matters in Eskom and so on. But on the prosecution side, and of course, I mean, I speak to our colleagues on an ongoing basis in the NPA. And as you know, that the independent directorate was put up so that it can investigate and also prosecute those matters arising from state capture. But of course, there hasn't been much traction. And I saw that the director of public prosecution with her team, they made a public appearance explaining to the public. So the issue of the permanence of ID and resourcing and so on come up. And it's not like, you know, there hasn't been anything done. And I say so because we do collaborate with them. We second some of our members to ID. In the Eskom space, there's been, you know, few cases enrolled for prosecution. We have seen the Matsela Koko case that has been withdrawn to our disappointment. But of course, the NPA has come up and said they would like to appeal that. So overall, yes, we are really concerned that the prosecution is not really following as quickly as it should. But yes, I mean, the public would have really listened to what the director of public prosecution and her team has got to say. So they have promised the public that they will now sort of prioritize all these matters. We're looking forward to that. That's what we want to see. That's what the public wants to see. Because in the absence of that, Jeremy, in the absence of that, we run the risk that the impunity that we have seen in those years covered by the Zondo Commission is likely to perpetuate. And we don't want that.
No, we don't. Advocate Motibi, I want to ask you this question. Given that this is a conversation and a podcast about fixing South Africa, in other words, putting us on a better path, when it comes to corruption, is there a measurable level or target that we could aim at in which once we've achieved it, we can turn and say to ourselves, well, we are on the way to repairing things? Or is that yeah. is it possible to work towards some kind of metric?
Jeremy, it is possible. And why do I say that? It's because, as you know, that one of the measures that has been used by the world at large is the Transparency International tool that measures various metrics in the countries. But that tool now has come up for scrutiny, because you would know that on that result of Transparency International, most of the countries, particularly in Africa, are at the bottom rung of the rating. And the bottom, I use bottom relatively, that no, they are not doing well. But we have looked at that tool. The tool, it's almost like they question some of the, you know, players in the country. They use their chapters. In South Africa, the chapter for Transparency International is Corruption Watch. They talk to Corruption Watch and they talk to others, but they don't engage us as those who are responsible for contributing to the fight against corruption. So there has been questions behind that tool. Now, why do I say it is possible? Fortunately, we are part of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. There is a draft measuring tool that has been developed, and Transparency International was also part of this. So that tool has really not been adopted as yet, because the last time we discussed this was in December last year. So United Nations is still processing that. Part of the elements that are looked at in that tool, of course, is the effectiveness of the investigation, the effectiveness of consequence management, including prosecution, including civil recoveries. But also it looks generally at the other criminal aspects, which is money laundering and so on. And then they look at the outcomes of the FATF, they call it FATF, which is the Finance Action Task Team. But in the country, they look at sort of the level of implementation of projects, and then there's a way that they would be measuring the extent of civil activism, the inclusion of civil society in the fight against corruption, which we have started doing as SIU, of course, on behalf of government, including civil society. That's a very important aspect. And of course, they will also look at, unfortunately, they will probably continue to look at the rating agents and so on. I mean, I say unfortunately because, there's always been a question around the rating agents. But that tool, we're looking forward to that tool being implemented soon. So there is a possibility of measuring. But in terms of the target, it has been discussed and debated. It's going to be very, very difficult to really put a target. But, just in last week, where Minister Gordhan was quoted in the public saying the corruption has cost SAA, Transnet, and Eskom about 271 billion. I think they put it at that number, So imagine that if those are only as state-owned entities under Minister Gordhan's portfolio, what about the other SOEs? And what about the departments? What about the private sector?
Yeah, I mean, the figure there would be absolutely astonishing. Advocate Motibi, let me pivot the conversation slightly, if I can, away from measurement. And I want to talk a little bit about bravery. One of the ways in which we're going to fix corruption in South Africa, I would imagine, is to encourage more whistleblowing. And that in itself is a conversation which is important. But the reality is that often there is a perception that they are not protected enough. Yeah. Again, you in your investigative role would deal with whistleblowers all the time. Do you agree with that assertion? And what needs to change in order to improve the dynamic?
Jeremy, thank you so much for that question, because the plight of whistleblowers is very, very important. I just read, in fact, last week sometime, I read that the CEO of the Tembisa Hospital has passed away, right? Mm. And he passed away in the face of the disciplinary process that was underway. But today I read that he's going to receive pension payout. And I'm using this as an example. You'll see where I'm getting to. A pension payout of, can't remember how many millions. But they say in that report that, you know, he was part of siphoning that more than 1 billion from the hospital. And that was reported as a result of the Babita Diokran whistleblowing, right?
Mm.
That is a very, very important example. And we know that Babita Diokran, you know, was killed. Now, directly as a result of the whistleblowing that she did, and may her soul rest in peace indeed. And we were part. She was possibly going to be a very key witness in our case. And now, every platform we take to, Jeremy, is that, you know, we of course need to protect the whistleblowers, but we also say every moment where a whistleblower or a witness, because, you know, we've got a whistleblower stage, and then you transit to becoming a witness. Not always that whistleblowers would be witnesses, but in both instances, whistleblower and witnesses, we need to protect them. But they also need to sort of work with us and assist us in instances where they feel that there's threats to their lives. They need to, you know, really reach out to us, SIU, NPA, Hawks, and so on, so that we kick in the mechanism. There is a mechanism at NPA, although it is called Witness Protection Mechanism. We have also invoked that mechanism to protect the whistleblowers. A typical example that I can give is when we were investigating in the Life Esitimeni investigation. Life Esitimeni is that health investigation we did in Gauteng, including the mental health institutions, which prejudiced a lot of mental patients. There was a lady who was a whistleblower, and she was possibly going to be a witness. She came to our offices one day, almost early evening. She said to us, I'm not going back to home. She stayed in Soweto. She says, no, I got threats that I'm going to be killed for reasons of having given information around Life Esitimeni and the wrongdoers there. And I personally called the director of public prosecution at the time. It was still Mr. Sean Abrahams at the time. And we immediately got hold of the person who is in charge of the witness protection program. We got that lady into that program. But that's just an example, Jeremy. We are on record as government saying we need to improve the whistle. I mean, we've heard there's a lady at Transnet, a well-known whistleblower. I think I just forget her surname, but her name is Martha. You know, I'm sure she wouldn't mind if I mention her name, because she's gone public. There's a lady at SAA who has joined the whistleblower house. I just forget her name. So we're working closely with those. But what is happening at the moment, Jeremy, to improve the space? Although we do have mechanisms at the moment where we become aware that whistleblowers are at risk, we take them into this program, make sure that they are protected with the budget that we have. There is a bigger process going on, which is led by the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services and the Department of Justice, of the amendment of the whistleblower legislation and building in improvements, including what I think it was mentioned at the Zondo Commission, including whether there shouldn't be, you know, an entity in government, you know, responsible for whistleblower protection and managing the legislation. So we are part of that. I know there was a benchmarking process that went as far as Canada. Now, but it will possibly now come up in the new administration where we push through the legislation to improve the whistleblower protection, having taken into account the experiences and the reports from Zondo, reports from SIU, reports from Hawks in terms of and listening to the whistleblowers themselves in terms of what needs to be done. So I agree with you that there is a concern that whistleblowers need to be protected, and there is work that is being done, because we know, we often say, we depend on them. We really depend. Without whistleblowing processes, there is no way that we will win this war. It's corruption. There is no way. So without protecting the whistleblowers, we can really, really forget about winning the war against corruption. So we need to strengthen those mechanisms and ensure that the whistleblowers are protected. Jeremy, there's another living example I can give you now. In the Home Affairs, you know, the president has signed a proclamation for us to investigate in the Home Affairs, dating back to, I think, 2018 or so, even before. But there's a man that Minister Motsoaledi and I went to see on the 1st of May. That man, of course, his name will be protected. That man is so willing and is a retired, officially retired sometime this year. He's willing to whistleblow, right? But guess what? He has really experienced prejudices to an extent of his life being threatened. So now the team is working with him. I have said to the team, go there. In fact, as late as today, they've went to him to finalize the affidavit so that we can now get him included in the witness protection program. The part to note about the witness protection program is that it uproots you. It uproots you from your home. But of course, understandably, that those who would like to kill you, they would do all their means to find you where you are. So we're working with that person to make sure that his life is protected and he can continue to collaborate and contribute to the investigations to really deal with those officials in Home Affairs and those who are corrupting the officials to deal with the corruption at Home Affairs.
Advocate Andy Mutebi, thank you very much indeed, not only on shining a light on the importance of fighting corruption and fixing South Africa, but also for some of those concrete and very meaningful examples, and particularly the focus on whistleblowing. Head of the Special Investigating Unit, Advocate Andy Mutebi, thank you so much for joining me on this Fix SA podcast. Thanks for listening to this Fix SA podcast. For more episodes posted every second Friday, go to moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.